Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Kristen Turner, and this is New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking to Coretta M. Pittman about her book, Literacy and a Long Blues Note, Black Women's Literature and Music in the Late 19th and Early 20th Centuries, published by the University Press of Mississippi in 2022. Pittman explores two distinct but related eras of Black women's writing, the women's era of the 1890s and early 1900s, and the New Negro Movement of the 1920s and 1930s. Casting a wide net, Pittman analyzes fiction, nonfiction, and dramatic writing by Black women, along with songs performed and written by classic blues singers like Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, and Victoria Spivey. This innovative approach allows Pittman to show how women from these two generations approached issues of class, respectability, uplift, and empowerment. Thank you so much for joining me today. It'll be great to talk about your book.
Thanks for having me.
So what brought you to this topic?
Well, I have always had a real interest in music. I don't sing, but it is a passion of mine. And I've always really enjoyed the Harlem Renaissance. And as an undergraduate student, and also really in graduate school, I realized that reading the scholarship on both the Harlem Renaissance and the blues era, I realized there wasn't much conversation among the women of the period. And so I began to kind of think about, like, what was going on? Why didn't the women who wrote and performed blues not talk to the women that I know of, that I could find, not talk to the women who were writing literature and drama and poetry in the same era? And so that's how I began to think about this project, trying to find a way into the minds of each of these women, really thinking about questions around race.
That was actually one of my questions about why did you decide to have blues women in that later era, the New Negro era, but then you don't have anyone from a theatrical or a musical background in your earlier chapters on women's era. You know, the first person I thought of would have been Aida Overton Walker, who wasn't a singer. She was a choreographer, but she did write some about these issues. So what made you, I guess, decide who you were going to pick from each of these two eras?
I think my thinking was I wanted to lay a foundation, a kind of theoretical foundation for what literature is, or how Black women like Anna Julia Cooper define literature, and Victoria Matthews. And I thought, if I can find a way to have a kind of intellectual conversation in my mind and in my words with women who laid a foundation around the kinds of productions, creative productions, that would bring African-American people out of, you know, poverty, out of emancipation, into freedom creatively and also materially, then I probably should start with texts that are explicit about that particular goal. And so I had been thinking about Anna Julia Cooper, reading her a little bit, and I discovered that she had written an essay on the role of Negro literature, essentially. And I thought that's the kind of perfect piece for me to begin with, and maybe to understand why the blues women were not included, given the kinds of creative expressions that were important to both Anna Julia Cooper and Victoria Matthews. So that's why I started there. And I'm actually not even familiar with the woman you just mentioned. She doesn't sort of come up in my research. But Anna Julia Cooper did, and Victoria Matthews.
Well, actually, that's really interesting, because that probably goes with your point that women from different era, different walks of life, and different class designations, which was important in your book, maybe didn't talk to each other. Aida Overton Walker, I think she would have thought of herself as middle class when she was working, but she was a choreographer married to George Walker of Williams and Walker, right in that women's era period. And she wrote a couple of essays that came out in like Colored American magazine, and where she talked about just the very same issues that you're talking about here, uplift, what women in the theater could do for uplift. And, you know, while I don't know that she would belong to a club, but she was very much had that sort of club women's ideas about uplift. And but I'm not aware of any women in that period that were analogous to the classic blues women of the 20s and 30s, where they were actually writing their own music. Black women. I know of white women who were performing and writing their own music in that period, but I mean, I'm sure I'm missing some, but I don't know of any women that are similar to the classic blues women, that some of whom were performing music written by others, and then others, as you pointed out, were performing and writing their own music.
Yeah, I'm thinking right now, I'm not even aware of any at the moment. I could be missing some names, but I can't think of any right now.
I can't think of it, not in popular music.
Yeah.
Maybe in sort of parlor music, but yeah, I would have to go back and look. I can't think of any either. So I am a musicologist. And so I have to say that the concept of literacies, which you talk about a lot in this book and is of course in the title, is one that's new to me as a musicologist. So I was very interested in learning about it. And so I'm sure that some people who listen to this podcast will be familiar with it. But just for those of us who might be coming from the music side, and this might be a new concept, can you explain what you mean by literacies?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'm going to go back a little bit. So my specialty area is in writing studies. And in graduate school, I focused on literacy, critical literacy. And what I mean by that, or the scholarship means by that, is that I concentrate most of my work on the ways in which people use written language to express themselves. And I'm also interested, I've also been interested in the ways that vocal music is a form of literacy, particularly for Black women who are of the elite and middle class, and Black women who are from the working class. And so there's this idea that there are different kinds of ways that people who are in different social classes use words and language to express themselves. So what I say in my book is that there are three types of literacy that I think Black women used from about the 1880s to the 1930s in my book, in the ways that I'm talking about it. And one is a kind of transformational literacy. So the idea, this is represented mostly by Anna Julia Cooper and Victoria Matthews. The idea is that you want African-American people to become educated, particularly middle class, as we think about the ways that middle class people use language, to uplift the race. And so they should learn so-called standard English. So dialects, at least in the late 19th century, are not appropriate, right, for the kind of education that will uplift the race. And so they want a kind of transformational, expressive language that is going to influence the ways in which white society viewed then African Americans. And I also say what begins to happen is that you can see this in I think Rachel, which is written by Angelina Grimke, is that you have this middle class family who believes in education, who believes in middle class values, who speaks and writes in standard English, and yet they are barred from all the material rewards that that particular kind of language and style affords their white counterparts. And so that transformation that they're seeking, both for themselves and the external white community, just doesn't happen. But it remains, I think, an intrinsic part of Black society at that time. And I would say even today, where it becomes important to at least know the language, know how to use literacy in ways that's uplifting. But then there's also another kind of literacy that begins to emerge. And I call that a kind of transactional literacy, borrowed from Henry Louis Gates, who talks about it as well. And that particular literacy says, I'm going to learn middle-class English, to learn to speak it and to write it, and maybe even use it in my creative expressions, but I'm not going to use it for uplift because it doesn't really uplift community, maybe just for myself, for my own family values. And that becomes sort of problematic, but it affords a certain kind of material comfort to some beginning in the 20th century. And I use Jesse Fawcett's Comedy American Style to kind of flesh that idea out with kind of transactional literacy. And then finally, there's a kind of specular literacy that I talk about in the text, where you have women like Zora Neale Hurston and the Blues Women who say, I can speak and write in standard American English, but I'm going to choose not to because I value the language, the vernacular, the styles of the people in my community. And so I'm going to reflect that kind of literacy practice in the ways I write creatively, but sometimes also culturally and in behavior. And so that's, you know, how I see from, again, the late 19th century to about the mid to late 1930s, these different kinds of literacies colliding within the Black community, sometimes based on social class.
So there's a couple of things I'd love to pull out of that great answer. And one is about class. So that is something you begin the book talking about, how thinking about class has been something that you've thought about for a long time. That's an important kind of through line in your scholarship. And how do you see class affecting these kinds of issues that you're talking about, such as the issue of, you know, dialect or no dialect, for instance, or the ways that people express themselves, and also the idea of what uplift is even.
Sure. Well, I think, I mean, you know, based upon, you know, enslavement and emancipation and Jim Crow, I mean, there's always been this struggle around, one, what's good for, quote, the race. We don't really use that term anymore, but how does one comport oneself? And so there's this idea that of respectability, politics that comes up in the late 19th century. And I would say that Anna Julia Cooper is trying to kind of work out and even sometimes challenge ideas around respectability. But it seems to be that there is a way of comportment both in the body, in the dress, in the speech, in the style, that they believe wholeheartedly will change the minds and the opinions of white society. And it's usually women in the elite classes, it seems, who articulate this vision. Again, both in their theoretical texts, like Anna Julia Cooper and Victoria Matthews, who say there's certain kinds of literacies, there's certain kinds of behaviors that we want everybody to adopt, to imitate, so that we can uplift everybody. Because the idea is that if white people respect us, then we can have, I wouldn't say all the rewards that are afforded to them, but we can live peaceably in this sort of new nation as it's forming after emancipation. But what happens is there are women who challenge this idea of social class and hierarchy. And I say that, you know, the Blues Women are key, and Zora Neale Hurston, and he's not in my book, but Langston Hughes, fight against this idea that the working class, that the masses need to adopt a certain kind of speech pattern, behavior in order to enter into so-called white society. But I think this is a struggle that continues today, because we're always sort of talking about how does one comport oneself in public, what kind of words they use, how do they write, are they writing effectively, are they communicating in standard English? These are all conversations I think emerge out of our discomfort sometimes with who we are and how people perceive us as a society.
Another thing that I felt like was coming through was how much all of the people that you're looking at were responding to, one, the pressures and disappointments and traumas of being second-class citizens, legally being second-class citizens. And then the other one for, maybe for everyone, but certainly more specifically for your early writers, is the trauma of enslavement, because both Cooper and Matthews were born into enslavement, and certainly they were living at a time when they knew plenty of people who had experienced enslavement. Whereas your later writers, that would have been a slightly, they would have been a generational, there's a generational remove there. And I wonder, maybe we can start with sort of, what do you see as the influence for your earlier writers, and maybe all of them, but sort of on that experience of that experience of enslavement and the trauma of enslavement and also the dislocation of emancipation?
Well, I think you're right to make the case that both Cooper and Matthews would have been more intimately connected to enslavement than the women who come after them. And so they understand in many ways the kind of physical trauma and the emotional and psychological trauma of enslavement and why they relied, I think, so heavily on this value in education that was going to release them from the physical and both and the psychological bonds of enslavement. But also, you know, I have to say too that Anna Julia Cooper is kind of different. She's highly, highly educated, even by today's standards. And so while she understands enslavement, she's sort of entrenched in this educational sphere in ways that nobody else around her is. So she's a very unique individual, historical individual. And then Matthews understands because she's a journalist, she's a writer too, and she's clearly aware that the person who writes the story sort of owns the narrative. And that's important for her because she wants everybody else who has suffered, experienced that trauma, even up close, distant from, to write a different kind of narrative that I think allows them to tell a story about themselves that's never been told. And that's another part of the, I think, the impetus for both of them writing those two essays on the value of literature, is that who is telling our story, whether it's a story of enslavement or a story of freedom or a story challenging their second class status. So I don't know if that sort of answers your question, but I think they're uniquely positioned to both understand and see, and then to kind of write out of those experiences.
Well, Who Tells Your Story, I think, was one of the ways that I felt like this book really, really resonated with issues today as well. And Cooper wrote, the essay that you focus on with Cooper, I felt like it could have been written yesterday, right? So could you talk, and I won't ask you to talk about all of these individually, definitely don't have time for that, but I was just really struck by that particular essay and how it resonated so much with issues of how important is that who tells your story makes such a huge difference. And can you talk a little bit more about her particular points there and why they're important to you and also just sort of the larger conversation?
Absolutely. Well, first, I find her remarkable because she's writing this in the late 19th century, and she's writing with a lot of biting wit for a woman, for a Black woman. Though she's of, you know, higher class, she's still a Black woman. And yet she challenges really some literary giants. She challenges Mark Twain and says, "You're not telling the right story about us in your novels." She challenges William Dean Howells and says, "The way that your Black characters speak in your novels is not how we speak. That's inappropriate." She challenges ideas around the relationships between, you know, Black people and white people and the kind of maybe love and admiration that they might have for one another. She challenges the thinking around those relationships in ways that I found just absolutely fascinating. She challenges Harriet Beecher Stowe and says, you know, your version of Black masculinity is incorrect. I mean, she names them in the actual article. And I'm thinking, who is this woman who decides that she has the right, and she has the right, to challenge some of the, what we call the superstars in the field for not depicting Black life, Black speech, Black culture in a positive way? And so she says to Black writers, you have a responsibility to go out and to write novels to write poetry, to write drama, all the kinds of creative expressions that we have, you must go out and be better and do better. Because if you don't, then this is what, this being Mark Twain, William Dean Howells, those are the kinds of people will rely on to tell our story. And so I was just fascinated by a person living in the 19th century who thought, yeah, I'm just going to challenge Mark Twain. Okay. I don't know people I do know people who do that in contemporary life, but it's not very often that you find writers kind of challenging one another in such a direct way. And so I was just taken aback and moved by that and thought, I've got to use this essay because it's so important to the foundation, I think, of what the role of American literature and African-American literature is in society. What also struck me about her is that she considers herself a citizen. Like she says, I'm an American, and we're writing American literature. We're not writing British literature. So let's stop using their models. We have people in this country who, and she's talking about the enslaved, who could be muses for us. She says, you know, we should use them to write that great American story. And we're not. She says, you're using stereotypes to write so-called great fiction. And so I could not use her text there. That's why I'm so drawn to that particular essay.
I was actually particularly surprised, maybe, or I don't know what the right word is, shocked even, that she was challenging Stowe so much, because I mean, that Uncle Tom's Cabin was very important in rallying abolitionism, and to then call that play out for an incorrect depiction of masculinity and enslavement when, you know, I was clear then as it is now that that was a very important text in the road to emancipation. It was very, very interesting that she was not going to let anyone get away with anything. She did not care. Great.
She did not. And Victoria Earle Matthews does the same thing. She says, okay, we know that Stowe writes this great novel, but we also can do better than that as well.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if Black women somewhere in a women's club were talking about, okay, we know how important this text is, but there are some deep flaws with it, and we've got to speak out about it.
Another one of the texts that I really liked that we haven't talked about yet is Of One Blood by Pauline Hopkins, right, which to me is just like, that is a crazy book. And it has this sort of early fantasy, proto sci-fi thing going on, a little bit of Afrofuturism. I mean, it was a very interesting book. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about it and why you included it. And she's in this sort of almost transitional space in the way that you have organized the book. So I'd love to talk a little bit about her and like where you see her in this arc that you're building.
Right. Yeah, she's another fascinating Black woman writer from the late 19th, early 20th century. And I chose Of One Blood because once again, I was like, who is this woman writing all these kind of strange ideas at a time when many of the women writing weren't really focused on those issues in their novels. So I chose Pauline Hopkins for a couple of reasons. One is that the main character is passing. He's highly educated. He's in Harvard Medical School. And the book seems to like draw a line between this transformational kind of literacy that's important because it opens with him, you know, essentially being identified as the best medical student there. He's intelligent, he's handsome, and yet he's very poor. His best friend is rich, so he can kind of see and touch elite life, middle-class life, but doesn't quite have it. And then there's this introduction of the Fisk Jubilee Singers in the novel as well. You have this beautiful woman, and she's a sort of a mulatto, a tragic mulatto, who's educated as well, but again, can't really touch the elite class that they're seeking, but wants it. It's very clear. And so I think Pauline Hopkins allowed me to kind of have a conversation about what is the actual role of education if you can't do anything with the education that you have. And then this kind of education that's in a school setting, but then there's the education that happens in Ethiopia that's of the mind and the body and the spirit. And so what kind of education is that? Do we leave that kind of education alone? Do we push that to the side because it's not respectable, or do we embrace it? And so she allowed me to have a different kind of conversation about what is the role of literature? What is the role of education and literacy, and what kinds of literacies actually free people and allows people to have conversations around race as well. I was, again, fascinated by her choices in that particular text. So that's why I included her.
One of the things that did jump out at me is you did have more than one text, of One Blood being one of them, where a character was passing. And I wondered if you could sort of talk about this idea of passing. Why do you think that this comes up in multiple ways, in multiple works? Why have a passing character?
I think for Pauline Hopkins, so passing allows an African-American who is ambiguously unidentifiable to move through white society. And so there were, characters in her novel who consciously decided to pass. And then there are those who don't quite know that they're passing. I won't give it out too much. I don't want to say too much. But it's really actually complicated, Kristen, because on the one hand, do you have a character who's passing because you value a certain kind of physical body? Is that what's going to encourage readers to read your novel? Because they might identify, if they're white, they might identify more with a character who has their phenotypes, right? The other thing it allows the person to do is to move within two worlds and to both try to understand what it means to be Black in white society and to be white in white society. And so I think that's kind of one way that she's using Raoul in her novel. And then in Jessie Fawcett's Comedy American Style, she actually seems to deride passing. Like, passing isn't really a good thing in that particular novel. The main character who is passing sometimes and who wants her children to pass is mean-spirited. She has awful things to say about African and African-descended people. And so I think Fawcett says this is really not the ways in which we want to use our education. We don't want to use this education that we have access to demean our own people, to get access to the economic rewards that we think whiteness affords certain people. And so I think she's challenging and poking at passing in that particular novel. It's just not a good thing. Whereas Pauline Hopkins is trying to understand, what access to that means and what are the outcomes to that access. And so they use it very differently. In Comedy American Style, the main character is using that as a transaction. It's only to get something. And in the end, it causes all kinds of trauma and pain. Whereas in Of One Blood, there's a kind of a reconciliation that's happening with literacy and language and passing. So it's very, very different, but also, really, really complicated.
So let's turn to the musicians. One of the things you do is you identify these classic blues singers who are, Black women primarily, who are making a lot of recordings in the 20s and 30s. These are incredibly popular recordings called Race Records at the time, and accompanied by a small band of some kind, usually. Sometimes it's just piano, but it's usually a little band. And they are not normally identified as being part of the New Negro movement.
Right.
That is, I think the whole idea of New Negro Movement, at least in musicology, is slowly coming in and getting away from just talking about the Harlem Renaissance, where you sort of have to, everyone has to be in New York is helpful. But still, even then, it still is unusual to have blues singers be identified in that way. Can you talk about why you see them as New Negro figures?
Well, it's interesting. They are existing all at the same time, sometimes in the same city. And know the same people. And I say they also care about the same issues. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring those women into conversation with the Harlem Renaissance writers and even the Black women writers of the late 19th century. Because my other premise in the text is that what I'm saying is we often think of the blues women simply as entertainers, and also sometimes as idiot savants. Like a Bessie Smith is sometimes considered a savant, but a kind of idiot. Like she just, the music's in her. She's not really thinking about, you know, performance. But what I did was I went back and I listened to their music, but I also kind of read very carefully some of the lyrics. And they were writing and stealing each other's lyrics. So we know that. But I thought, these are women who actually do care about the masses of Black people suffering from racial oppression, from economic exploitation, in ways that they don't get credit for. And so on the one hand, you have a Jesse Fawcett trying to understand the impact of passing and education and family dynamics. And you have even... again, Pauline Hopkins thinking about these very questions. But so are the blues women. And I think I just sort of came to the conclusion that they may not have been talked about a lot outside of Langston Hughes, but they were still doing important work for a demographic of people who most folks wanted to change, who most folks said, we want to take your vernacular and transform it so that you can be uplifted out of your poverty. But there are different kinds of ways to do that. And so that's why I thought it would be important to include the blues women, because they're living alongside these other women at the same time.
Oh, definitely. What do you think is the, I mean, it's hard to say what a primary message is of these blues women, because there's so many songs and so many different individual, you know, individual songs to parse through. But if you had to, I'm going to put you on the spot, if you had to kind of give you kind of an overall idea of what you thought was the aesthetic viewpoint of many of these blues singers, or at least the blues singers that you focus on in your book, what would you say that was?
Okay, I would say there are some themes that come up for all of them. Number one, I think they say, for me, they introduce this notion of a different notion of, around love. What does love look like with two Black people? What kind of love is that? And they do it in a way I think that's very intriguing. So they talk about some, let me be very clear. When they talk about violence, I am not affirming the violence that they kind of poke fun at and sing about in their blues songs. But I think they help us to consider how Black people actually love, which doesn't come out a lot in the novels, I think, that I talk about in my text in the same way. They're also talking about repression, racial oppression, and what that looks like. They talk about, I mean, Ma Rainey talks about the chain gang, you know, what that looks like. She talks about alcohol. So she's talking about like the cultural things that I think happen exclusive to what other Black women writers are writing about in the 1920s and 30s. And they're also talking just about everyday life, how to navigate a life that's really, really hard. How to have fun in that life, how to love in that life, how to live in that life. And so that's what I would say. I don't know if I'm answering your question, Kristen, but I think there are lots of thematic issues that come up out of these blues women. But I also think it's a nod to valuing the ways in which they function in the everyday experiences of their lives. Again, in ways that their counterparts aren't really doing, in a sense. And so that's why I talk about the kind of specular literacy that comes out of the blues. So their music isn't saying, I want you to be like somebody else. It's saying, I want you to navigate the life you have with what you have and make the best of it. And if that's singing and dancing and maybe even, you know, a little cutting up sometimes, then that's okay. And I think their fans wanted to hear that at a time when, again, everybody's saying you need to be something else. Even if it's for the greater good, you still need to be something else, says you're not valued in some ways.
I definitely don't know the literature from this period nearly as well as I know the blues, because I'm a musicologist, but I gotta say that the blues for me are messy in a way that the literature doesn't seem to be. Like, it's okay. You know, there's this sort of ways that they're saying, it's okay if your life is a mess. You know, we're gonna get it through. We don't have to look perfect from the outside for somebody else. We're just gonna muddle through, is how I often hear that music and hear that in their voices as well. As a musicologist, I think a lot about how their voices embody the kind of pain and trauma, but also fun, right? And kind of the late nights and the lots of drinking. And, you know, you could hear it in their voices, the strain in their voices, the sort of fuzziness and graveliness of their voices in a way that someone sort of from the middle class doesn't sing that way, you know, and it doesn't read that way when you read the literature, even with someone like Zola Neale Hurston, who is using dialect, but it's still... Right. It's still not quite that messiness. So
yeah, I often tell my students, you know, like when I was in college, I was listening to rap. I didn't listen to it in front of my parents when I was at home in high school, but it, you know, in college, we're all playing rap music, and I'm listening to somebody like Lil' Kim, whom I would absolutely never play in front of my parents, and she's got all these provocative lyrics that I'm not used to hearing, but I like the beat. I like the sounds, the, you know, how she's delivering the words. And that's what I think about when I hear Mamie Smith's Crazy Blues. You got 1920. I mean, Grimke has released Rachel. It's kind of a middle-class lynching drama, talking about the muddled life of middle-class Black people in the North, the struggles that happened there. And then you've got a woman singing Crazy Blues, who's like, I've got a man. I'm so crazy about this man. He's cheating on me. And by God, I'm going to get him for it because he's cheating on me. I mean, what a dichotomy there around middle class life and the struggle for acceptance. And then this idea that I'm not really interested in that right now. What I'm interested in is telling you this love tale about this man who's cheating on me. And the woman is so angry that she decides, well, I'm not going to hurt myself. I'm just going to go kill a cop. I'm going to take my anger out on an external figure. Who does that in 1920s? Mamie Smith. I mean, she sings that song. And so I'm just really intrigued by this willingness to step outside of middle-class life. And as you mentioned, sort of express the messiness of life in blues. And people, I mean, they loved it. I mean, absolutely loved it. And there's, I know it's complicated, but it's still, I think, an important part of Black creative expression that needs some additional conversation.
So Ma Rainey is one of the figures that you talk about, and she's a very interesting singer. And one reason is, and that you do talk about as well, she has a group of songs that are about same-sex attraction or about lesbianism. Bessie Smith has some of these too, but you mostly talk about Ma Rainey, and that's another one of these messiness of life, right? And she also projected herself often in sort of a gender nonconforming way for that period. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of... I guess the queerness that's going on in her music and how that might also fit into some of the other, you know, themes of your book.
Right. So she's another one who decides that she's going to kind of break form and talk about same-sex attraction same-sex desire in song. And I think what I found most interesting, again, is I'm talking about this idea of Black love here too. It doesn't show up in the book as much, but I think Ma Rainey and Mamie Smith and Victoria Spivey are pushing the envelope and are already kind of expressing what's happening in the culture anyway. So we know that same-sex attractions, they're not new in 1920s America or 1930s America. And yet she's willing to, as a singer, as a performer, perform these kind of queer songs about same-sex attraction. And I'm drawn to that as a researcher, again, because I think it's important that we listen to all the voices of a particular period to understand historically what's happening in society, but also what's understanding what's happening in the Black community and how people express their desires, their fears, their hopes. And I just find it fascinating that she was willing to do that. And I also have in the book, there's an ad for that particular song where it shows her like in more traditional kind of masculine attire. And at the time, I think it's in the Chicago Defender. And at the time, I could not believe that the Chicago Defender would have that ad in her with her dress in more masculine dress with two women by her side. And I was like, what's going on here? Like, what is this saying about, you know, creative expression? Who gets to be heard at this time and why? I wasn't learning about Ma Rainey and Prove It On Me Blues in my undergraduate education. I was learning about Langston Hughes, W.B. Du Bois, Zora Neale Hurston. And so I was just struck by that moment. What is it saying to us? And I couldn't help myself. I had to include that in the text because I think, again, to go back to my point earlier, that she's kind of trying to reflect the culture and saying back to people, it's okay for you to be and love who you want to love. We're just going to sing about it and move on. Like, it's a part of everyday life. And so that was important for me.
Well, I've always been amazed, not only that she was willing to sing about it, but that somebody recorded it and released it in mass circulation. Because it's one thing to sing about that in the clubs, but then it's a whole different thing to put a business plan with that, you know? And it's such a moment in time where that's coming out in ways that honestly, I'm no expert in this, but I just don't think that happens in white culture in this period. You know, it's really something that Black women are able to do in the blues that I don't know, like white women, I don't know that are doing that in jazz, for instance, in the analogous in the 1930s. You know, you just don't see it. So it's a very interesting moment when you also have at the same time this incredibly important literary movement that's doing something quite different. So.
And I suppose to it, they can do it because they're not, well, I don't know, like, let me go back. So Ma Rainey is not trying to be a Jessie Fawcett, a middle-class Black woman. She knows who she is and she knows her audience. So in one sense, I don't even think the way I understand the music and the music that she wrote, it didn't really matter to her whether or not that music was going to upset her more middle class African American peers. I mean, she was a musician who wanted to perform. And so she wasn't looking to kind of climb out of that social sphere. She economically, yes, but socially, no. So she wasn't trying to do that. And I think that matters as well. So if you want to join a certain class, maybe you say, I'm not going to do that music. And she does walk away from blues and becomes, gets back in the church. But at the time she's performing Prove It On Me Blues, she's not trying to be invited to a salon with, you know, Jessie Fawcett and Elaine Locke. She's not interested. And so I wonder if some of that, maybe that empowers her in a way to say, I'm going to do and sing what I want because I don't want to be that. I don't want to be in that. But I want to talk about my own people too, though.
Yeah. Well, this is a really fascinating book. I really appreciate you spending time talking to me about it. Now that you're through this project, what are you working on now?
So I am obsessed with Pauli Murray. Last year received a Schlesinger grant to go to Harvard to look at her archives. And I was able to go there for a week last June. And I have over 700 pages of her materials. And so my next book is going to be on Pauli Murray, probably focused on her two autobiographies. One published in 1956 called Proud Shoes, and then the other one, 1987, called Song in a Weary Throat. And I'm just interested in her life is as fascinating to me as the blues women. And so I'm just kind of really interested in the ways in which she creates and crafts this person that she thinks she wants to be, in a sense. So I'll be spending all of my time reading her work and writing about her the next couple of years.
Well, she is quite a subject for that, and such a fascinating person. So I'm so glad to hear that you are taking a deep dive into Pauli Murray. I live in North Carolina. I live 30 minutes from Duke University and the Pauli Murray Center there. So she's certainly an important figure in my neck of the woods as well. So, well, thank you so much for having this conversation. And my name is Kristen Turner, and this is New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. And I've been talking to Coretta M. Pittman about literacy in a long blues note, Black women's literature and music in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, published by the University Press of Mississippi in 2022. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.